Reading is from Matthew 26, verses 14 to 16. Then one of the 12, who was called Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and said, "What will you give me if I betray him to you?" They paid him 30 pieces of silver, and from that moment he began to look for an opportunity to betray him.
During this season of Lent, we're going to be exploring the Enneagram, which is really a 9-point system of spiritual awareness or self-understanding. And there are 9 points to this system, to this understanding of one's motivations, deepest motivations. And they took the 7 deadly sins that the Catholic Church had talked about, the 7 deadly sins, and added 2, deceit and fear. So that gives us 9 vices that we are going to be exploring in the next 5 weeks during Lent. So we're going to be primarily doing 2 each week. And so today we begin with our first 2. Socrates said, "Know yourself." Freud said, "Be yourself." And Jesus said, "Give yourself." I think that's a good maxim for soul work. The first step in knowing ourselves is excavating those shadow aspects of our personality that we would rather not face. But as Jesus reminds us, we needn't be afraid, for it's in loving our enemy and forgiving the rejected parts of ourselves that we finally find ourselves. For in losing our egoic personality, we discover our divine self, the gold nugget, as Carl Jung would say. So today we are beginning the Lenten journey based on the 9 passions of the Enneagram, which, as I've said, is the 7 deadly sins plus 2. And for this brave and inward journey, we need not only to be brutally honest with ourselves, but we also need to carry with us a large dose of self-compassion and kindness towards ourselves. As Susan Maitrey, in her book, The Enneagram of Passions and Virtues, which I would highly recommend, learning to see ourselves clearly is itself the heart of this process. And being willing to see ourselves as we are is only possible with infinite self-acceptance and kindness toward ourselves. We must forsake our judgments and have the utmost compassion for ourselves, knowing that this is just the way the things are in the world of ego. When we do this sincerely, when we face our reality as it is without any blinders, and we bring the full weight of the intelligence of our souls to bear on the conundrums represented by the passions, then, as she says, we stand a good chance of getting in touch with the virtues in time. This means getting in touch with them in the only way that matters, through the process of our own transformation. And that's what the spiritual journey is all about. Change from within, so that there may be change outside. And so today, on the first Sunday in Lent, we begin to face the first 2 ego aspects that were responsible, as all of them were, for the crucifixion of Jesus and the continuing source of pain in this world, because we still continue to crucify one another. So we turn to the first vice to virtue, the vice of avarice or greed. You will see in this painting of avarice, painted by Paul Cadmus, an American artist who just died in 1999, in his part of a series, he painted the 7 deadly sins, between 1945 and 1949. And we see greed personified like an ugly, emaciated, haunted, skinny creature clinging to a gold coin. Avarice or greed is defined as the insatiable or excessive desire for wealth or gain. In our scripture this morning that Jan just read, Judas is supposedly motivated to betray Jesus from the vice of greed for 30 pieces of silver, which by the standards then would be about $600. A lot of money when one piece of silver was a week's wage. You and I live in a society consuming itself by greed, in our ravenous consumer grasping for more. It is in our clinging, hoarding, retaining, and being unwilling to share generously of our resources, or sometimes of our knowledge, or sometimes of ourselves and our time, that we find ourselves cut off and separate and isolated. Some of us come to the vice of greed or avarice differently. Some of us hoard our funds, afraid that we won't have enough. Others hold on to possessions, imbuing them with great value and being afraid of losing them. Others clutch at status or power or a sense of self-importance, while others may hold on to their partners for dear life or their children. There are a multitude of ways our greediness can show up. But all of our greediness is rooted in the fear that we will not be nourished or supported in our lives, that our very survival is not assured, and so we experience an internal contractedness and a holding on to and a holding back of oneself, one's energy, one's time, one's resources, safeguarding and preserving what we have. And so within the vice of avarice is attachment, of attempting to secure and hold on to things. We become attached to pleasure, attached to our beliefs and opinions and perspectives, attached to our own religions or rituals, attached to our own sense of our ideal self, attached to the way things are. And ironically, it is in the letting go, which Jesus talked about all the time, of all these things that we find ourselves. And to lose ourselves, we need to first fully engage and enter deeply into the experience and accept change. That change is a constant stream into which we must wade and understand that we cannot fix or hold on to anything or anyone. In her book, Sandra Maitrey says that science reveals that we are all moving at a dizzying pace, literally. No wonder so much of us suffer from vertigo. The ground beneath our feet is in motion. The earth is circling the sun, moving at a speed of 18 and a half miles per second. Hold on. Which calculates as over 1,000 miles per hour. That's what we're doing. When we think we're standing still, we're actually moving at a ridiculous pace. And our entire solar system is circling the Milky Way at 140 miles per second, or 500,000 miles per hour. So why are we surprised that life is constantly in flux? when our whole solar system and galaxy is propelling itself in circles. So life is constantly in flux and nothing stays the same. We don't, and no one else does. Everything is impermanent. Nothing is worth grasping because nothing lasts, like clouds moving through the sky. Knowing that nothing is secure, that there is no solid place to stand, we can therefore let go and let be and come to rest in the chaos. Being fully to the and present to the moment, engaging with the totality of ourselves, with our hearts and our minds and our bodies, we can dive into any experience that life brings to us with an attitude of curiosity and begin to question the assumptions underlying our beliefs and emotional states and attitudes. This inquiry is what leads to non-attachment. This engagement, which opens us to ourselves and this vulnerability and intimacy, relaxes our gripping and our clutching to ourselves and to what we have. This non-attachment enables us to let go, to look at ourselves from a non-attached perspective, and enables us to experience that actually we're not separate from the ground of being, but that we in fact are secured in the very ground of our being, and our impoverished attitude of grasping ends. And we realize that there is nothing to hoard, to hold on to, that all is coming and going and free. We realize that we are a part of everything. And this is the beginning of true generosity, which is the expression of non-attachment. As Sharon Salzberg said, generosity has such power because it is characterized by the inner quality of letting go and relinquishing, being able to let go, to give up, to renounce, to give generously. When we practice generosity, we open to all these liberating qualities simultaneously, which carry us to profound knowing of freedom. And as the Buddha said, no true spiritual life is possible without a generous heart. When we know that our nature cannot be attached to, when we recognize that we cannot hold on to any idea or opinion or time or thing or person or tradition or aspect of even ourselves, our soul can finally at long last relax and let go and open up, and giving and receiving become the same thing. And so we discover that it is not in the clinging or the grasping for more, but in the letting go and letting God and letting be that our soul is finally at home. As Jesus said to Mary in the garden, "Do not cling to me, for I have not yet ascended." It is in our refusing to grasp and to cling that we can finally make our way home and rest in God. So as we sing Kyrie Eleison, let us rest in God alone and let go of all of our grasping and be ready to be filled by the presence of the Spirit.
Yeah.
The second reading is from Matthew 27, verses 15 to 18. Now at the festival, the governor was accustomed to release a prisoner for the crowd, anyone whom they wanted. At that time, they had a notorious prisoner called Jesus Barabbas. So after they had gathered, Pilate said to them, "Whom do you want me to release for you, Jesus Barabbas or Jesus who is called the Messiah?" For he realized that it was out of jealousy that they had handed him over.
As we can see in our next painting by Paul Cadmus, envy is a state of the heart and arises like poisonous snakes out of the heart of a person, as in the painting by Paul Cadmus. Envy arises out of the heart when we are not content with ourselves as we are. We think that the grass is always greener on the other side, and we operate from a perceptual illusion that others have a better life than we have. Others are more gifted than we are. Others are more popular and liked than we are. The more sinister side of envy shows itself when we take secret delight in the losses and sufferings of those we envy, and it becomes the breeding ground for gossip and slander and backbiting. We tend to see the positive, the good, the ultimate outside of ourselves, and we can't stand it, so we want to hurt it, or at least bring it down a notch or two. As Maitri reminds us, spiritual envy is the tendency rampant in spiritual communities to point out the flaws in another, to focus on where they are not developed rather than where they are, and to undermine the esteem another is held in. Some of us envy the physical and financial security others possess and wish we have that security. Others envy the largesse and beauty of another's home, wishing that we had that beauty and grandness. Others might envy another's health or their looks. Others might envy another's family closeness or their ease with which they seem to make and keep friendships. Others might envy someone's social prestige or respect or accolades. Others might envy a lifestyle or a tradition or a past. We see this envy in the assumptions we make around one group of people and seeing them as all good or all bad, and not seeing the fullness of an individual, the flaws and the gifts. We see this envy in the showdown between peoples. Peter Salovey writes that envy is most likely to be experienced when comparisons with another person, a rival, are negative for the self, and these comparisons are in a domain that is especially important and relevant to self-definition. In other words, envy is a painful or resentful awareness of an advantage enjoyed by another, joined with a desire to possess the same advantage. But unfortunately, when we give in to our envy, envy leads to a feeling of lack and badness within ourselves, and the feeling that the other is somehow superior to ourselves. And this can lead to wishing we were or had what another person has, which leads to resentment towards the other for having that which we desire, which then leads to hostility toward that person for having that, and begrudging someone because we feel our own sense of deficiency, which makes us feel all the more bad about ourselves. And in order to defend ourselves against feeling badly about ourselves, we feel enmity and even hatred toward the other. As a result, envy is a state of deep turbulence and inner unrest and has the potential to move to malice and hatred, which is the desire to get rid of the object causing us so much upset and to annihilate and destroy. Melanie Klein suggests that envy is the basest of the seven deadly sins, because as she writes, I would even suggest that envy is unconsciously felt to be the greatest sin of all, because it spoils and harms the good object, which is the source of life. When we envy another, we are in one movement idealizing the other and what they have, and at the same time rejecting ourselves and what we have. We are, as a member of our Bible study group said as we were exploring these passages, we are comparing our insides to the other person's outsides and thinking that's the truth. When we envy another, we do not see them in the context of being a whole individual. With gifts and stuff, yes, but also difficulties and heartaches and dilemmas. Whether we envy a family or a company or a class or a race or a nation, we do not see them in their entirety, and therefore neither do we ourselves see ourselves in our entirety. And we miss the goodness that is our own and the gifts we too enjoy. This brings us to what is needed to work through our envy, the virtue of equanimity, which means with equal mind, which is emotional balance, even when under stress. This balance is only possible when we bear all of ourselves, and I would say, and bear the balance, we bear everyone else as their self with an equal mind and heart. If envy is the movement of abandoning ourselves, when we do not fit into an inner picture of how we think we are supposed to be and grasping for those qualities in another, equanimity is an openness to the whole of ourselves. Letting go of the ideal image of ourselves in our minds instead of deserting or discarding ourselves. As Ishatso says of the virtue of equanimity, it is balance. A whole being lives in complete harmony with their environment. Their moves are economical and always appropriate to their circumstance. When living in balance, we are not emotionally affected by external stimuli, but respond to them exactly as much as is necessary. Equanimity is one of the marks of enlightenment, that capacity to look from the highest viewpoint, to see from the balcony, from that seagull perspective, to see from the broadest panoramic view, the big picture of things, when everything falls into perspective. When we see the balance of things, the good and the bad, the shadow and the light. Equanimity is a spacious stillness of mind, a radiant calm that allows us to be fully present with all the different changing experiences that constitute our world and our lives. When we are able to take in the whole of ourselves, the shadow and the light, we are enabled to do the same for others. When we can perceive and appreciate the entirety of others, the flaws and the gifts, we become at peace with them, and we can live in harmony. Otherwise, we are divided within ourselves, and our relationships to others can only likewise be divisive. So the very attitude of equanimity, not valuing one experience over another, or not valuing one person over another, or not valuing another over ourselves, allows us to be with the whole of our experience, and in so doing, we can experience our own wholeness, our shadow, and our light. Melanie Klein sees the resolution of envy as beginning with gratitude, which she views as gratefulness for enjoyment and its source and our capacity to appreciate and take in the goodness of another and what life presents us, recognizing that goodness is something that is implicit in our nature and in the nature of the created order, that there is beauty and blessing in the essential being of all things, and God saw what God had created, and behold, it was very good. Jesus' religious colleagues envied Jesus his goodness. They envied him his wisdom. What means do you get this authority? They envied his popularity, his capacity to heal. And it made them feel less. And so they set out to destroy him. But the story of Jesus and Easter is a story that what we set out to destroy can never be destroyed. That love and goodness will always prevail, because goodness and love is the source from which we all come. So let us, as we begin embarking on this Lenten journey, begin to be transformed this day from envy to gratitude to equanimity, that we might know the fullness and totality of our own wholeness. May it be so. Amen.